I want to see this bill passed so that no more children are exposed to PFAS-contaminated water.
A bill in the state legislature would regulate the chemical PFAS in the state's drinking water. From Alaska Public Media, this is statewide news on Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, March 15th. Good evening, I'm Wesley Early. Also tonight, an Alaska oil and gas expert's idea for the state to make money by not drilling in Anwar.
Why are we holding on to these leases? Why are we paying $3.5 million a year for something that's never going to return anything?
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The future looks bright because the University of Alaska is on a mission to empower Alaska. From drone piloting to vital climate research to critical mining solutions, the University of Alaska's three universities and their community campuses shape the jobs and careers that fuel the economy, creating a more empowered Alaska for all. Learn more at empower.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska.
Yesterday, the Environmental Protection Agency proposed the first ever national limit on PFAS compounds in drinking water. The chemicals have been linked to cancer, liver damage, and high cholesterol. Here's EPA Administrator Michael Regan making the announcement.
We anticipate that when fully implemented, this rule will prevent thousands of deaths and reduce tens of thousands of serious PFAS-related illnesses.
The news comes as one Alaska senator continues his fight to regulate PFAS, which have been found in drinking water from the North Slope to Southeast Alaska at the state level. KTOO's Claire Strempel has the story.
State Senator Jesse Keel took the mic at a rally for clean water protections on the Capitol steps in Juneau. He said the EPA announcement is great news, but he still needs to pass his bill to stop contamination before any more gets in Alaska's drinking water.
The most important thing we can do in Alaska today is turn off the tap.
Keel represents Gustavus, where PFAS from firefighting foam has contaminated drinking water, soil, and berries. He's tried to regulate PFAS for years. Keel's current bill, SB 67, would outlaw firefighting foams that contain PFAS and require the use of safe alternatives. The foams are typically used on fuel fires at airports, and Keel says they're the main source of PFAS contamination in the state.
We all have to put out fires. Everybody recognizes that. There are safe ways to do it that don't poison our firefighters, that don't poison our drinking water.
Michelle Meyer was at the rally. She is Tlingit and grew up in Yakutat, where PFAS contamination from firefighting foams has been documented.
I drank the water at my elementary school for years and was contaminated, so I am coming to terms that I can probably attribute it to my exposure.
She was diagnosed with what her doctors called a rare form of leukemia when she was in her late 50s.
I want to see this bill passed so that no more children are exposed to PFAS-contaminated water.
PFAS chemicals are linked to cancer, among other ill health effects. But it's hard to attribute specific illnesses to them because they accumulate in the system over time. Meyer's son, Connor, joined her on the Capitol steps. He said he'll never forget the pain of seeing his mother so ill and preparing for her death. He also attributes his mother's illness to PFAS, and he says it could have been prevented.
All of this came because she chose to stay in a place that she was culturally connected to. And it scares me that living in the village is not responsible health-wise, that the inaction from the government and from community leaders around this topic have created an unsafe space for children to grow up.
Alaska does not regulate PFAS in drinking water. That will change when the EPA's standards take effect. The manager of the state's drinking water program is supportive of the move.
I think this is a step in the right direction.
Cindy Christian has worked for the state agency for nearly 25 years.
PFAS has been an issue throughout the country, and the EPA has committed to promulgating this rule.
Christian said the state will adopt federal standards when they're finalized. That will limit PFAS in drinking water to 4 parts per trillion, a tiny amount. Water systems throughout the state will likely be required to test their water and treat it if PFAS are present. For example, the municipal water in Fairbanks has PFAS in it. The levels aren't a violation because Alaska doesn't regulate them, but they will be if the new federal standards take effect. Patrice Lee is an advocate for clean air and water in Fairbanks. She testified in favor of Keel's bill this week.
Scores of lakes can no longer be fished in. The fish cannot be taken or eaten. And my very favorite family place, the Piledriver Slough, where we've always spent Mother's Day, can no longer be fished in.
The public has 60 days to comment on the EPA's proposal. The agency expects to enact the standards by the end of this year. Once that happens, the state will have 2 years to adopt the new rules. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Claire Strimple.
ConocoPhillips got approval this week for developing its Willow Project in the National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska. But another area the state has been hoping companies develop, the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, has received almost no industry interest. The Alaska Industrial and Development Export Authority is currently the only leaseholder in ANWR. The state is sending millions of dollars to the federal government to hold the leases. Instead, Alaska oil and gas expert Larry Pursley wants the state to consider selling carbon credits for keeping oil and gas in the ground in ANWR. He laid out his proposal in a recent op-ed in the Alaska Beacon and says it's a serious proposal, even if it's not likely to happen.
I don't think Alaska's political leaders are willing to admit there will be no ANWR development. And like I say, you'd have to go and get the feds to cooperate because the federal law says if you got a lease, you got to produce it or get off the pot, or get off the lot, I should say. And I think the argument would be not producing it and selling carbon credits does not meet that requirement. But to me, it seems an elegant solution. We don't have to, the state could hold on to leases, make some money. The federal government could share in the credit of not developing it, which wasn't going to happen anyhow. I think there'd be a lot of buyers out there. They would find it very high-profile, opportunistic to pay for the credits of not developing ANWR.
So you touched on this a little earlier, but can you give a quick overview of how we got to this moment regarding ANWR from the Trump presidency to the Biden administration?
Sure. So, you know, Alaskans certainly have been wanting to develop ANWR pretty much, I think, since Earth was created in the Big Bang, probably that long. And that's been argued about for years and years. There was legislation passed by Congress said there will be lease sales. There was one. It was rushed through in the Trump administration, the very final days. Essentially, nobody bid but the state of Alaska. There were a couple small non-oil and gas producers that put in very small bids, and they later said, you know, in hindsight, we'll give you back the leases. We don't want them. So the industry, I think, is looking at ANWR, looking at the high visibility of ANWR Arctic oil and gas development, and they just don't want any part of it. So the Biden administration came in, said, hey, those were rushed leases under Trump. We're going to put them under review. You can't do anything. We're going to think about it. We're going to ponder it some more. We'll get back to you.
There's been a lot of talk about carbon credits lately. You know, essentially companies could purchase these credits to offset their own carbon emissions.
Yes.
And the governor has also proposed allowing companies to lease depleted Cook Inlet oil and gas reservoirs to store carbon dioxide. What do you think of these plans to lower emissions while also making money for the state?
Well, right now, anything that makes money for the state would be great because we refuse to tax ourselves, and oil is not exactly a growth industry, Willow aside. So I think the governor is proposing these carbon credits to divert attention from the fact his budget doesn't balance. We do not have a diversified source of revenue. We don't want to tax ourselves. So he's conjured up, we could make billions of dollars by selling carbon credits. There is a market for carbon credits, no doubt about it. Other places are doing it, but the purchasers of these carbon credits are getting more skeptical. They're saying, wait, is this legit in terms of you're promising not to log in the Amazon or you're promising not to log in Alaska? There is growing skepticism in the market for carbon credits where companies want to know they're real. And it really means carbon is going to stay in the ground, not the atmosphere. And that's why I think something like oil and gas that doesn't get produced is much more attractive than trees that don't get cut, which we're never going to get cut anyhow.
Right. And you mentioned earlier that your plan does have a hang up and that federal law does say you have to drill in your oil and gas leases. How would the federal government have to shift things to make your plan work?
Well, that would assume that I actually put legal research into it. I don't know if it would take a regulation or a law. I think it'd probably take a change in law. But it was also a column I wrote to just get people thinking, why are we holding on to these leases? Why are we paying $3.5 million a year for something that's never going to return anything?
You note that at the end of your op-ed that this is a dream, albeit a sweet dream. From your perspective, how likely do you think your dream could become a reality?
Probably not. I mean, I dream about a lot of things in Alaska for 50 years, and most don't become reality. But I guess I also want to make the point, okay, you don't like my dream, find another, because right now you're writing a check for $3.5 million a year on leases that are not going to produce because there is just no industry interest in it. So pick another dream or keep writing the checks for nothing.
That was longtime oil and gas policy expert Larry Pursley speaking on his latest op-ed in the Alaska Beacon. Officials with Governor Dunleavy's office did not respond to a request for comment on Pursley's proposal. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, three Alaska Native mushers finish at the front of the Iditarod Pack.
Hopefully inspiring to another generation of kids in the villages in rural Alaska or anywhere, you know, to, you know, take on a crazy sport like this.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Grant applications are now being accepted for tribal justice grants through the U.S. Department of Justice. Coordinated Tribal Assistance Solicitation, or CETAS grants, fund tribal courts and tribal law enforcement, open to federally recognized tribes across Alaska. Applications are open until March 21st. Learn more at atjrc.org/CTAS. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tribal Justice Resource Center.
According to the American Civil Liberties Union of Alaska, state corrections officials have been forcing a man serving prison time in Seward to take psychotropic medications against his will for years, well beyond their legal authority and egregiously violating his rights. The civil rights organization sued the Alaska Department of Corrections today on behalf of 47-year-old Mark Andrews. Andrews is serving a 99-year sentence at Spring Creek Correctional Center for a 2001 murder and robbery in Nenana. Alaska Public Media's Jeremy Shea has more.
The ACLU wants the court to address Mark Andrews' situation and to strike down the corrections policy on involuntary medication as unconstitutional, which could affect many people in state custody with mental illness. During a press conference about the lawsuit on Wednesday, ACLU staff attorney Melody Vidmar described her client's experience.
Over the course of the last 5 years, Mr. Andrews has been held down, handcuffed, and repeatedly and involuntarily injected with psychotropic medication, which can have devastating effects on his physical health and his cognitive capacity.
The ACLU complaint provides more detail. It says Andrews, who was diagnosed with schizoaffective disorder, has chronic pain in his stomach, intestines, and chest, bad enough to keep him bedridden at times. These are all known side effects of the drugs. He's been on these medications voluntarily since about 2013, and then involuntarily since 2018. Corrections policy is supposed to limit involuntary medication to emergency, last resort situations when there is imminent danger. According to the ACLU, Andrews has not been written up for aggressive behavior since about 2018 and had no serious altercations with others in custody since 2011. Corrections policies lay out an internal hearing process to review involuntary medication cases, but the ACLU says that process is deeply flawed, and Andrews didn't have any opportunity to participate in one until several years had passed.
And when DOC finally afforded him a closed-door internal hearing last fall, the department conducted the procedure so haphazardly, it blatantly denied his constitutional right to procedural due process.
A Department of Law spokesperson says in an email that one of its attorneys will respond through the court process. ACLU Alaska Prison Project Director Megan Edge says concerns about health care in the prison system are widespread. She says about half of the hundreds of contacts she gets each month from people in prison are about health care. She says about 1 in 7 people in the prison population have a severe and persistent mental illness. The ACLU has a separate lawsuit pending against the Department of Corrections it announced last month. That case has to do with some people in corrections custody being denied access to programs and services for transitioning back to life outside of prison. In Anchorage, I'm Jeremy Shea.
The state of Alaska is claiming victory in a subsistence case argued before the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. The state challenged the authority of the Federal Subsistence Board to open an emergency hunt aimed at helping people in Cake get food at the start of the COVID-19 pandemic. The board allowed a 60-day emergency hunt for moose and deer. By the time the case was before a judge, the hunt was over. But the Ninth Circuit Court ruled this week that the judge was wrong to dismiss the challenge as moot or no longer applicable. The appeals court said the state should be able to make its case to a district court judge because similar circumstances could arise again. When Ryan Reddington crossed the finish line in Nome on Tuesday afternoon, he became just the sixth Alaskan native musher to win the Iditarod in the race's 50 years. The two mushers on this year's podium that finished behind Reddington made the day even more historic. Pete Kaiser and Richie Deal are also Alaska native. The three men say they want to show that rural Alaska mushing isn't dying. Alaska Public Media's Lex Trinan has more.
When Pete Kaiser arrives at the finish line in Nome, he's excited despite narrowly missing out on his second Iditarod win. Part of the reason? A historic podium sweep by Alaska native mushers in this year's Iditarod. He says it feels special.
To have three out of four in the top three is, I mean, it's almost unheard of, you know, and aside from some of the earlier days of the race when there was more participation from rural teams and native teams.
Just four Alaska native mushers started this year's race. Mike Williams Jr. from Akiak is still competing. Kaiser, who lives in Bethel, and Antioch Strichy Deal, who placed third, say they hope their finishes inspire the next generation of mushers, particularly those in rural Alaska in a year that featured the smallest field in race history. For years, dog teams off the road system in Alaska have been dwindling. But Kaiser and Deal are at the forefront of a small but meaningful resurgence of rural mushing. They live in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta, one of the few rural hotspots where major competitive dog races still take place, like the Kuskokwim 300. Deal says the community in the YK Delta has been exceptionally supportive, which allows mushers like himself to maintain their kennels.
There's a lot there to it, but I think it shows that in some parts of Alaska, in rural Alaska, that mushing isn't dying.
Reddington, Kaiser, and Deal consider themselves friends, but competition was fierce in the final 300 miles of trail. The three teams ran at a similar pace in the first half of the race, near the front of the field. Then Reddington, whose mother is a Inupiaq from Unalakleet, surged ahead with two monster runs. Kaiser opted for longer rest instead at one of the final checkpoints. He says he knew his decision might let Reddington slip away, but his team needed a break between Koyuk and White Mountain.
You know, some years you can do that run if they're set up for it. Other years you can't. So
Kaiser says he felt that Reddington was particularly motivated for the win this year.
I knew he'd be real tough to beat coming up the coast. I knew he had a lot of motivation and determination to get it done. And we did too, but, you know, there can only be one winner. So
still, he says they were all friendly at checkpoints, trading stories and tips.
You know, we're competitors, but we're a small-knit group, and we kind of all know each other pretty well. And yeah, it'd be a long day out there if you weren't friends with anybody.
Kaiser says while he was hoping for a win, notching a strong showing for rural and Alaska native mushers was special.
I think it's great, maybe hopefully inspiring to another generation of kids in the villages in rural Alaska or anywhere, you know, to, you know, take on a crazy sport like this.
All three mushers say they'll keep competing and motivating young mushers, but first they say they'll need a nap. Reporting in Nome, I'm Lex Trinan.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the Westmark Fairbanks Hotel and Conference Center, located in downtown Fairbanks with 400 guest rooms and 1,700 square feet of meeting space. Reservations at westmarkhotels.com.
Parents go to great lengths to protect their little ones. When it comes to protection from childhood diseases, go with the safest, most effective choice. Start strong by getting all recommended vaccines for your baby by age 2. Learn more at vaccinate.alaska.gov. That's vaccinate.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health.
City officials say Juneau's short-term rental listings may have increased by about 300 in 2022, more than doubling the previous year's total. Most of the listings are for entire homes or apartments. Scott Chambor, Juneau's planning manager, says the trend is contributing to Juneau's housing crunch.
Short-term rentals is definitely you know, impacting the overall housing stock and the availability for folks looking for housing to find it.
Last summer, the city hired a contractor to comb through listings on Airbnb, Vrbo, and other sites. City Revenue Officer Ruth Kostick tracks sales tax in Juneau. She's presented the investigation's findings at a Juneau Assembly Finance Committee meeting earlier this month. Kostick said the Ironman Alaska race contributed heavily to the increase, but many of those listings are still up despite the announcement the race won't happen again this year.
I was curious to watch and see post-Ironman, especially once the cancellation, if we'd start to see some of that tick back down, but we haven't really seen that play out in the numbers just yet. So it's actually still growing.
Kostick says it's hard to get an exact count of short-term rentals. Some listings were duplicates and some appeared on some days and not others. That's possibly because people were putting up and taking down listings to hide their unregistered rentals. A 2022 survey of Southeast Alaska business owners found that 72% cited the region-wide housing shortage as a major concern. Chambor says other factors play into the housing crunch, like rising housing costs and limits to development in Juneau. And there's no easy fix.
And there's no real, magic bullet or, a definite, guidance to follow.
But he says other cities have taken actions on short-term rentals that the city and borough of Juneau could consider. Across the country, tourist towns have limited the types of units that can be used as short-term rentals, how many nights a rental can be rented, and how many short-term rentals can exist in a municipality. Last fall, Sitka approved a requirement for owners of new short-term rentals to live on the registered property for half the year. Ketchikan is also looking into various limitations on short-term rentals. This February, the Lower Kuskokwim School District rolled out an innovative Yugtun language test for K-6 students in the district. They're also piloting a new test for 7th to 12th grade, too. As KYUK's Sunny Bean reports, this test measures all of the usual stuff, reading, writing, listening, but also nonverbal language and the Yupik worldview.
Yugtun is the most commonly spoken native language in Alaska and the second largest in the U.S. after Navajo. Bethel is the hub for Yugtun speakers, and now the language is finally getting a curriculum and test that captures its core.
It's hard to get really excited about a test. This test is really different for me.
That's Christina Power Robbins, the director of elementary education for the district. She said Yupik elders, parents, teachers, retired teachers, and community members transformed the test. So it measures things like speaking, reading, and writing, but also nonverbal skills and the Yupik worldview.
Unlike perhaps what things have happened in the past, we're not looking for students to check their culture at the door.
This district covers a region with more Indigenous language speakers than any other part of the state. And in the majority of schools in the district, the kids are learning Yugtun and English. Around 2010, the district began to pilot a comprehensive Yupik immersion curriculum that not only teaches the language, but brings Yupik values and stories into the classroom.
This gets a little bit in the weeds, but I just want to...
She pulls out two textbooks to show me. One of them has a picture of a woman and child crossing the street on a crosswalk. It says, "I look both ways before I go."
There are not streetlights in village communities, and in Bethel there's only the one that I have a picture of, and it doesn't ever turn green.
So Robin asks, what are they actually trying to teach?
Is it this is how a crosswalk works, or is it about rules? And this is actually a unit about rules. So our picture for that same page, when we localize it, says rules also keep us safe. I listen to an elder. I stay away from dangerous spots. I respect others' property.
This new test is designed to see if their localized curriculum works. How the kids perform will shape how they design the curriculum in the future.
We also recognize that in defining what it means to be proficient in the Yugtun language, we're going to have gaps in our curriculum. There isn't a chapter in our language arts books that talks about nonverbal communication. It doesn't come up in science or in social studies.
Yet, for Yupik people, it's obvious that the raise of the eyebrows means yes, and a head bob after a compliment on your earrings is a subtle brag. There's arm signals to alert others about danger or a walrus or a sinkhole. And it's important to include all these things to help the younger generations learn the Yupik way of life.
For instance, in English, we have pronouns this, that, and those.
That's Waki Charles. He grew up speaking Yuktun at home.
In Yupik, we have 30 of these pronouns. And these are more specific because of location, how I see my world. This, that, those over there, those across there, those underneath, those up there, those that I can't see upstairs, those that I cannot see that are down below, maybe or upriver, downriver. And so the way that I see my world has a language by which I'm able to use my pronouns.
Charles teaches at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. He also runs the Alaska Native Language Center. He says what LKSD is doing is significant. Bethel has become a model for how Yuktun and other native languages should be taught.
They don't learn about things like skyscrapers or escalators or elevators.
He says what the district is doing speaks to the heart of the language. It's not just translating English. It's drawing out the Yupik way of thinking. When Charles teaches Yuktun at the university, he finds the younger generation often haven't had much exposure to native languages.
I begin the semester by saying, welcome to Yuktun 101, an emotionally charged language. Meaning, as we learn our heart language, there's going to be opportunities or times in which we'll feel elated, humbled, excited, shame, remorse, guilt, and at the end too, you know, this feeling of finally gaining access to that language that wants to come out from the soul.
Charles says he sees his students have epiphany moments when the language and culture click and they understand something they couldn't see in English.
They go, now know why, or wow, I didn't know that. So that's why my grandmother would say, holy, and then there'd be, yeah, there's tears. It's like, wow, now I know.
The new tests are being administered in the schools now and throughout March. After that, there may be some new curriculum on the way, too. In Bethel, I'm Sunny Bean.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Claire Strempel and Yvonne Crumry in Juneau, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Jeremy Shea in Anchorage, Lex Trinan in Nome, and Sunny Bean in Bethel. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde, Tim Rocky is our producer, and I'm Wesley Early. Good night.
Alaska Pacific University offers degree programs with life-friendly, flexible scheduling and course delivery options grounded in real-life experience. Alaska Pacific University offers innovative programming in nursing, counseling psychology, outdoor and environmental public health, and more. Financial aid is available. Advance your career with APU today. Learn more and apply now at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by Alaska Pacific University.
This is statewide news on Alaska Public Media.